Hi, everyone. Welcome to the April 22nd ASF Weekly Science Podcast. I have a special guest this week to talk about a very, what I find to be confusing topic, which is artificial intelligence and machine learning, and how it can be used to help people with autism. I have with me today one of the experts in this field. His name is Dr. Dennis Wahl. He's a professor of pediatrics and of biomedical data science at Stanford University. He's received many, many awards and his membership in many different academic organizations, but he's also co-founder of a company called Cognoa. And if you can't, we don't have this on visual, but he has a cute little Cognoa icon or figure in his background. And it is a company that is dedicated to speed up diagnoses of autism using these different machine learning and artificial intelligence platforms. So he's taking science, which I know can kind of be this kind of ambiguous. I don't really know what this means. Is it ChatGPT? What is it? And using it towards good in helping families with autism. So I want to thank Dr. Wahl for being here and let him introduce himself and talk about how he got involved in autism research because he didn't start here. He's one of the people that we snatched and grabbed to get here.
it's really wonderful. Thanks so much for having me on your podcast, Alicia. It's been something I've listened to for a while. I'm excited to be a guest. It's a real honor. So yes, I'm Dennis Wahl. I'm professor of pediatrics and biomedical data science at Stanford University and the founder of Cognoa, which is a company focused on digital child health with a specific emphasis on autism and other developmental conditions that manifest early. Our goal is to drive down the average age of diagnosis as best as we can so that we get children with autism diagnosed as quickly as possible and on treatments as quickly as possible because we know that those can really pay off if they're delivered early. We have the first FDA authorized medical device for diagnosing autism. And this device is called Canvas DX, and well, I guess we'll talk about this a bit later, but it's particularly interesting because the device uses artificial intelligence to make more informed decisions given the data that we collect that goes into the Canvas DX system. So we'll talk more about that later. My wife's sister has a severe form of autism. I've known her since I was a teenager. I've always wanted to do something in the space, and so while my training wasn't in it, my training was in computational, it was computational biology, integrative biology, which is really artificial intelligence and machine learning to big data. Here in this case, big data was like genetics. But once I got to my first faculty job at Harvard, focused the lab entirely on autism. And all my work has been in that field. Just because I wanted to find a way to take that computational training and put it to work. Felt like autism, the field of autism research could, bet at that time, especially, we didn't have a ton of quantitative approaches. And so I thought, okay, I'll bring some hopeful quantitative approaches into the field and see what happens. And that led me along this trajectory.
So, for most of the listeners who may have heard about artificial intelligence, here is the worldwide expert on what that means. Can you kind of tell us a little bit about artificial intelligence and machine learning and whether or not they're different? I hear them used interchangeably. I'm sure that's not correct. What are they and how are they used, not just in autism, because you're going to talk about that, but how are they starting to be used in our lives in general?
Sure. No, it's understandable that there's a confusion between the definitions of artificial intelligence and machine learning. They're very closely related, but you want to think of artificial intelligence more as the umbrella under which machine learning lives. It's a broader field, and it refers to the use of various technologies that make machines have human properties, essentially. That can reason, that can think, make informed decisions or predictions. And so that's the broad field of artificial intelligence, whereas machine learning is a subset of that field that enables a machine or system to learn and improve from experience. And so it's going to take data, it's going to look at patterns in the data, utilizing a specific kind of model, which is kind of how the data are structured together, to learn about patterns and then become proficient at inferring new things or to make predictions given the learnings that it's been able to glean from the data that we give it. So it's a very specific subset of artificial intelligence where we teach a model in a machine how to learn from data and what to learn from data and ultimately make predictions or informed decisions, new outcomes.
So what are some examples of how it's being used?
So you think of Netflix maybe as something that's quite common for people, and it's going to make new recommendations for which movies you might want to watch next. And it's doing that based on your patterns. And so it will take your tendencies over time and begin to learn what you like and then make predictions based on your patterns of history. And of course, it's going to be using other people's information who kind of look like you, you know, and ultimately there's going to become a pattern of genres that the machine learns, and it will make a recommendation. You can reject that recommendation and it will learn from that. It'll use a subset of machine learning called reinforcement learning, where you're really teaching the model based on your rejections or your acceptances, what to do in the future. So it gets smarter over time. So Netflix recommender engine is like a great example of common machine learning in practice for entertainment purposes. In the field of medicine, the most common forms of machine learning today, especially those that are passing through the FDA with diagnostic approvals, for example, are those that are focusing on image data, like radiological image data, and making decisions based on information it has learned over time from patterns of radiologists identifying specific aberrations in images. And it becomes as proficient, in fact, even more proficient in some ways than the radiologists can be on their own. Why? Because you can train the machine learning model on many more cases than a single radiologist can see in their lifetime, and many different types of scenarios that they may not have encountered in their own practice due to the demographics of the hospital in which they're operating. And so you can train models on like a global population of data and ultimately make them extremely proficient at decision support, but highly equitable at the same time, like highly performant across different demographic characteristics, because you can train it using that global population, whereas it's very difficult to train a single clinician who may not have the opportunity to see an image variation that would be specific to a different type of population that's distant from theirs.
I actually have one more example I just realized is treatments for diabetes. So these insulin pumps now have chips in them that go to a computer, and they can track about when somebody with diabetes will have a meal and their blood sugar will go up. They also track what their blood sugar levels at night are. And it doesn't happen overnight. For an individual person, they know in general kind of what happens and that information is fed. But for that individual, it learns, the machine learns after, you know, four or five pods or four or five of these little machine changes, what the basic pattern is. So, right. You know, if you eat, let's say you eat at noon, it will make tiny increases in your insulin around 11:45. It won't make huge increases, because if you don't eat at noon like you normally do, and it keeps giving you insulin, then you're going to bottom out. It's going to be a bad thing. So it doesn't make huge increases, but it does get to know your pattern so that it could better kind of predict and track when to best do those increases, and then also at night what your level is. So learning, it's kind of this precision, this idea of precision medicine, where a machine is getting to know you through its abilities to kind of store your information and your preferences. So,
and that'll be machine learning models can be calibrated. They can be specifically they can be trained to do well across a general population, and then specifically calibrated to you, to your individualized patterns. Take emotion recognition as a great example of a common form of computer vision based machine learning, where we train models, machine learning models, to evaluate a range of human facial expressions and predict what emotion those faces are exhibiting. But over time, it may not have a great handle on how grandpa expresses anger, but you can calibrate the model to be very proficient at the way in which your granddad expresses anger. So we've done that in my lab. We've done a lot of we've done a lot of machine learning modeling on emotion and emotion recognition, because it's important to for example for autism therapy, to teach children how to not only look to faces and find faces interesting, but to interpret the variation in the emotions being expressed in those interesting human faces. Even the basic emotions like happy, sad, surprise, those can be confusing for children with autism. But if they're taught those emotions in a naturalistic way, and artificial intelligence can help with this, we can do a lot to help them grow and thrive on their own. And so that's one aspect of the work that we've done in the field of artificial intelligence, just calibrating emotion recognition specifically for a child's naturalistic environment, making sure that it's really good at distinguishing mom's happy face or sad face, so that we can teach the child, or that an artificial intelligence system can help teach the child how to understand mom's face.
So Cognoa has taken advantage of machine learning and artificial intelligence to develop, as you already mentioned, an FDA-approved diagnostic tool. So, and it's called Canvas DX. Sorry if I didn't mention that already. So how does this use machine learning? So give us kind of like a scenario of what happens during a Canvas DX session and how machine learning plays a role in it.
Okay, Canvas DX is under the hood, under its hood is a machine learning model that we've trained. We've trained on hundreds of thousands of case records of children who were evaluated and ultimately diagnosed with autism or other here being speech and language delay or other types of developmental conditions that children in the same range of ages in which we're diagnosing autism get diagnosed. So it's this diverse data set of hundreds of thousands of examples of assessments made on children who ultimately received a diagnosis of one kind or another with a specific emphasis on autism. That's a cool structured data set. It's like a big matrix of observations, measurements made on children during that assessment. And that would include some traditional research instruments like the Autism Diagnostic Observation Schedule or Autism Diagnostic Interview Revised or the Social Responsiveness Scale or many of these other kinds of tools like the Vineland Adaptive Behavior Scale. These are things that are used in research for aiding and abetting the assessments and ultimately helping with the DSM diagnosis at the end. But they record a bunch of measures, like how much eye contact, you know, how much language, you know, do they have a social smile or joint attention? These kinds of features are all captured variously by these different tools. And they are captured in a way that represents, you know, numbers like categorical 0, 1, 2 type data, ordinal data as well, like where 0 is never and 3 is always. And yeah, so it's like never, sometimes, often, always, 0, 1, 2, 3. Categorical ordinal data. That's what I refer to it as. And that's that's what's in the matrix, this big matrix. You know, you think of it as like a, as like a, as like a skyscraper. You know, it's like really rectangular in shape. It's standing up like a skyscraper, and it's got a ton of samples of children's, you know, measurements across a range of features, these behavioral measurements. And we can ask fundamental questions about those data to try to find pattern. And this is what machine learning does. Machine learning is given some sort of data. It may or may not have class, which is the ultimate DSM outcome of autism diagnosis or not. If it, in this case, of course, it does. And so we can then think of it as supervised machine learning, where we're supervising the model with the classes to say, do your best to learn how to predict these classes, autism, from other, given the data that you have. And we can use a specific kind of model to do that, like a decision tree, like a form of regression, in this case, logistic regression. This is the math behind it. And really try hard to predict very well, predict very well with a minimal subset of features. We could say we want to make the feature space as small as possible, as constrained as possible, but without loss of predictive accuracy. Like, we want to predict autism from other as close to 100% of the time correctly as we can. Anyways, and so that's what we did with Canvas DX over a period of 8 years of gathering and experimenting and training the model to constrain the state space around features that are good for autism measurements, so that we can predict class with high accuracy. And ultimately, over time, it ended up being as smart as a clinician. And so the Canvas DX algorithm now has been trained on more, like I said, with the radiological example, more cases than any clinician can see in their lifetime. In fact, more cases than maybe hundreds of clinicians can see in their lifetime, because of that journey of 8 years of building data and then training the model with those data, so that we could capture as much of the diversity as possible to arrive at a feature space, like a set of features that are really predictive when combined the right way. And then, of course, when combined like with the model, this model here being the math behind it, like how you weight one feature versus another, given the answers that come in. The model learns all that and predicts the outcome. And the outcome we measure against, you know, the best ground truth we can arrive at. In this case, with, for example, the testing that we went through the FDA with, we're asking at least two clinicians to use a standard process of evaluation, a very rigorous neuropsychiatric battery, to arrive at an independent decision of whether autism is present or not. And if they disagreed, we'd get a third to get an agreement. So very rigorous ground truth against which we're benchmarking and testing the accuracy of Canvas DX. I'm probably being too long-winded here, but that's the way in which Canvas DX evolved and became what it is today through the FDA with an authorization.
So when you were training the machine, I'm going to use that as you were learning the machine, what were the videos that you were inputting? You had people volunteering, you had clinicians submitting videos, you had the actual, just tell me like how, because you want it to be as generalizable as possible. You don't want to have the same ADOS. And for people that don't know the ADOS, it's an observation tool, and the clinician asks the child and the parent sometimes to engage in specific behaviors, like here, blow bubbles, or, you know, look at what's over there. They'll have like a doll or something that they'll try to get the child to look at. So they're trying to elicit autism or autism-like responses based on a certain number of like stimuli. So how did you train the machine, I guess is the bottom line.
The training is based on the feature space that's created after an observation, like a traditional, for example, ADOS observation, in which there might be for ADOS mod one, like 10 activities like you're describing here, like, okay, yes, there'll be a birthday cake. You could blow out the candle with, you know, pretend birthday party, bubble play, Jack in the Box, whatever, those sorts of things that are part of the toolkits to elicit what might be autism-like behaviors or lack thereof, then those are measured, right? Those are measured by clinical observers in a categorical ordinal way, like how much did they do of one thing or another? Was it present or absent? Those sorts of questions are answered. Our Canvas DX system was trained on those behavioral measurements, those kinds of behavioral measurements. and then once it's identified as this feature space, it can use features coming from a video. Canvas doesn't just take video though. It takes a parent report and a healthcare report together with the video. So it's multimodal in that sense. It's like getting features from a parent or a caregiver, or features from an observing doctor who prescribes Canvas DX ultimately, and who is finalizing the diagnostic outcome for that child after all the ingredients for Canvas DX have been given and the outcome from Canvas has been made. And then there's this video feature. The video feature that Canvas receives is two roughly 90-second videos of the child in their natural environment. And it's relatively free form. It's not like an ADOS. We want much more naturalistic videos that are relatively unstructured because we trained our Canvas DX system to recognize features from those kinds of unstructured videos so that we can see things that might be difficult to pick up in an artificial kind of clinical evaluation where the child may be, maybe in a clinical room, less comfortable because they don't know the clinician who's observing them or working with them, less comfortable because they took, a long drive to get to that location, less comfortable or less typical maybe in their behavior because they're hungry, you know, those sorts of things that tend to confuse the more traditional clinical evaluations. We like the unstructured videos of the child in their home, in their own home environments, behaving as they do, as they are. And our and Canvas DX is really good at picking up, well, was trained to pick up the natural features that are exhibited in those videos and reflect upon how they may or may not indicate an autism diagnosis. But it doesn't just do that, right? It's like, it's combining the video features with the parent features and the doctor features in this multimodal way, but it's also multi-time, right? Because the mom's answering at one time, the clinician's answering at another time from a different perspective, and the videos could be videos that they have in their video library, like from a few months ago, or they take live, you know, on the spot because there's an opportunity to get a nice capture of the child's natural ways in which the child plays. So for example, they're playing with Legos or Matchbox cars or something like that.
So describe then the process for families headed for the Canvas DX. Yeah.
Canvas is validated in the pivotal registrational study with the FDA for telemedical use. So it can be used, although it doesn't have to be used telemedically. Doctors can prescribe upon first visit or prior to the arrival of the family for the first visit Canvas DX. This is commonly done. The order in which the inputs from parent, doctor, and video come are unlocked. They can come at any time in any order. We want them all present for Canvas DX to run. What we tend to see happen is that prescribing doctors will prescribe to their wait list and notify them telemedically or electronically. This is an assessment we're running right now. Please complete your steps. And when they come in, the doctor then has their videos and the videos available to them. They have the report from the parent available to them, and then they can finish their report. And once they do, instantly the algorithm will run, the prediction is available for them, and then they can conclude the session with by completing the assessment summary and providing the diagnosis, if it's present or absent, which is really very efficient. And so it will reduce the time for a diagnostic evaluation by by a significant margin, by many hours, making it possible for diagnoses to take place within a pattern of roughly 30 minutes or less, even in some cases. And also done, as I said, asynchronously, with some parts being done in advance and other parts being completed in the office, if there is an office visit, although again, it can be done entirely telematically, which we've done before. In fact, Canvas DX is now being used by the State Department for children overseas who are in need of a very, in dramatic need of an autism diagnosis. And the only option for them is to fly somewhere far away. And it takes a long time to get access as a consequence of that, where Canvas DX can step in as a complete virtual solution for providing that child who's, a member, whose family members or parents are a part of the State Department, an answer right then and there, for example, in Germany or, somewhere else. And those are some real world examples of where Canvas DX is now supporting, supporting, that virtual population that's out there in need. Likewise, for distant populations who are far, who are the 50-mile bus ride away or even further away, the opportunity for Canvas DX to step in as a telemedical solution is very real and hopefully very, very valuable and potent for providing the next steps for that child with respect to authorization for ABA if they do have an autism diagnosis.
So how is that done? I'm skipping around questions a little bit, but since we're talking about different races and ethnicities, and you mentioned different parts of the world where autism is actually sometimes seen differently. One example, and I'm not saying that this is the only example, but we hear in from a lot of friends in Asia that avoiding eye contact is actually a cultural norm, not necessarily an example of autism, for example. And that's just one, and that may not be for all of Asia. I'm just listing one. How did you train the machine or show the machine different examples of how autism presents in different parts of the world and in different races and ethnicities? How did you solve that?
Great question. Yes, we did. We fed the model during training a diversity of examples across the race and ethnic populations of the United States in particular. And that was specific for the pivotal registrational study so that we could have documented evidence of equity for the US population. And that was very successful. And when I say that, I mean that the statistics, the performance metrics of sensitivity, specificity, positive and negative predictive values did not change with biological sex or race and ethnic category. And so therefore there's evidence for equivalence. It doesn't stop there though. I think it's imperative that we continue to document that. One of the things that Canvas DX is particularly, one of the things about which I'm proud of having for Canvas DX is we trained it to abstain when it's presented with insufficient or fuzzy information, when it doesn't know. We trained it to admit it doesn't know. So like it doesn't just say yes or no. It'll sometimes say, I can't tell. I don't know. And so that's one thing that I think is really important for systems in medicine that are used, machine learning systems and artificial intelligence systems that are used in diagnostic decision support. If it's producing a binary outcome, I would be very suspicious of it. And because it's going to have false reporting just by rule. In our case, of course, we trained it so it wouldn't do that, that instead it would admit it doesn't know. That's a cool feature. I think it's one that the FDA should require for all AI-based systems that are used in diagnosis. The other thing that I'm particularly proud of or happy about Canvas DX is we were authorized by the FDA to adapt Canvas as we get new data. In fact, we're obligated to check its performance continuously over time and make sure it doesn't go down. But whenever it can go up in performance, we must make it go up. We must improve its accuracy and its ability to discern, its ability to make a call. Like, how often is it saying, I don't know, right now, it's about 30% of the time. If we can make that a smaller percentage, we will. And we've seen it moving already towards a higher determinant rate. That is, that window of indecision is shrinking. It will never go to zero, but it will shrink a little bit over time. And therefore make it more valuable in these situations where there is a high degree of clinical variation or symptom presentation that's confusing. The Canvas will get smarter and be able to manage those cases in a setting that's very distinct from a clinical specialist setting. Like, the obviously specialists are great at diagnosing, but they're rare. They're a rare commodity relative to the number of kids who need the assessments. And they're often far away from many of the children who will need care. And so so Canvas can step in as an intelligent collaborator for a community doctor who's working in general pediatrics, who may not have had proficient training on how to do specialist evaluations, but together with Canvas can actually achieve that same level of accuracy remotely out there in the world where they're operating, you know, in a rural part of the United States, or even, you know, a different part of the globe. And so coming back to equity and inclusion, this opportunity for us to adapt the AI over time, not only is an obligation, but an opportunity for us to continuously check and make sure Canvas DX is inclusive and equitable. We don't want it to just be available for those with money or means or with specific insurance plans. We need it to be available to all. And that means Medicaid, that means government support. Mm-hmm. And that, you know, and that's where we are spending a lot of our time and energy right now, is working with payers and policy groups to try to help them understand the value potential of this system.
What's the path forward for those who the algorithm is not quite sure and doesn't want to give the wrong answer? It's not that it just doesn't want to give the wrong answer. So what's the path forward? What do you recommend?
Every single child gets an individualized developmental assessment report, regardless of the outcome. Excuse me. And so this is another key part of Canvas DX. Canvas DX does a great job in terms of accuracy, but it also automates the note-taking and produces a detailed assessment report for every child that's written in a way that insurance companies need to have it, ultimately, for authorizing the next step, be that autism-specific treatments or other, in this case, speech and language, or potentially some other kinds of treatments and therapies that the child will need. That detailed assessment. So, by the way, that automation of the note taking, report generation, eliminates a lot of doctor burden, which is really cool. And it's a huge problem today that a lot of companies, a lot of technologies are trying to solve. Because in medicine, one of the biggest challenges doctors face is the effusive amount of note taking that they must do, and this distracts them from their main job and distracts them from doing their best to abide by the Hippocratic oath that they took. Here we have that same solution. Here we're producing automated outcome reports that the doctors can then tailor further if they wish, with their additional notes. And so for kids who don't get an outcome on whom the device is abstaining, there's going to be a ton of information there that the doctor can use, and they can make a decision.
So tell me about, there is this kind of relationship with a clinician. You keep going back to the person that diagnosed you, right? So you keep going back if you have a problem, if you need a yearly IEP evaluation. How do you see that happening? Is there some AI tools that maybe can be delivered to these general pediatricians or other people that might be that kind of support person or that go-to person? How do things get managed across the lifespan?
Yeah, great question. Well, right. I think the pediatricians, they talk about the medical home. We with Candace TX can have the child stay in that medical home. Whereas maybe today they're referring out and they're no longer in the home, right? They're now in someone else's home.
Mm-hmm.
You know, the specialist home. The specialist home is a harder home to get access to because there's a lot of demands on that specialist time. So the general pediatrician can become, yes, the primary care provider and maintain the child in their medical home for the trajectory that they need. Now, this trajectory we hope will be abbreviated to a certain extent. So take, for example, recent studies, including some nice studies at a Boston Children's Hospital documenting the persistence of the autism phenotype. Children diagnosed between the ages of 18 and 36 months, and then later reassessed at ages 5 to 7, asking, is the phenotype persistent or not? 37%, 4 out of 10, roughly, no longer had the autism phenotype. Therefore, reduced needs for services, dramatically reduced needs for services. Why is that the case? We believe it's because if diagnosed early and given some therapy, it's not so much about the amount, it's the timing. There's a higher likelihood of a positive outcome, you know, and therefore a reduced need for services. So to put that in a very simplistic way, if we find and treat kids with almost anything early, they're going to, many of them will progress to a point where they don't qualify for an autism diagnosis later and can enter mainstream schools and and do a lot of things very, you know, proficiently on their own and make their own choices and grow and thrive as they choose without any autism impairments, you know, without autism symptoms and preventing them, holding them back. And that's really cool. That's really exciting. So I guess what I'm trying to say is Gen Peds can do that. Gen Peds can support that identification and the supports needed, you know, with just a little bit of education, a little bit of tools. And so Canvas DX right now is providing those assessments. In the future, the Canvas app that the families have will contain more and more information for them to and for the doctors about what resources are available, what should you be doing, what kinds of skills can you focus on for your child, and those ingredients, which will be bite-sized and very manageable, can really support the journey for that family where the caregiver, to the extent that they're able, can act on behalf of and help fill the gaps in on care that the child will need in their homes using, you know, tools and ingredients that can, that Cognoa is building right now as the next steps for solutions in the pipeline, you know, so that we can make sure that the journey, if diagnosed at 18 months or 24 months and treated for 2 years thereafter, roughly using ABA and other kinds of things, many of those children will lose the autism phenotype by the time they're 5 to 7 years of age. And with cannabis over time, like actually 2, 3, 4 uses, a lot of the current prescribers are saying that they become proficient. Like they get really comfortable. They get really comfortable with how to do it, how to think about it. And so there's like a education through action, essentially, that's happening with cannabis.
Yeah.
And it's making doctors really happy and comfortable, especially with that abstention feature. Like when they get an indeterminate, they are comforted. They're like, okay, this device isn't crazy. It's not going to like knee jerk yes, knee jerk no. It's going to give me some guidance and I can take that to the next step.
Thank you so much for joining us, Dr. Wall. We learned a lot about machine learning, about how it can help autism, and how it can be used to shorten the wait list or potentially eliminate the wait list for an autism diagnosis.
Yeah, thank you so much. This is a real pleasure to be here.